Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the New York Times recent story that exposed information about Senator McCain's back in 2000, how he had a relationship with a female lobbyist. And the story itself, of course, was greeted with a great deal of censure from the press, even the New York Times' own ombudsman, the LA Times, and other press organs came to the defense of Senator McCain. But there's a real possibility this entire story was, of course, what is called an inoculation job, since the story itself was leaked by the McCain camp. They perhaps put it out, and the New York Times obligingly covered it, and essentially it will go away, and there'll be no more discussions about Senator McCain's extracurricular activities in terms of his marriage and sex life, if you will, because it's a subject that shouldn't be involved in political discourse, but the Republicans did cross that line with Clinton, and they should not get a free pass. We'll speak with Todd Gitlin, who is a professor of journalism and sociology and the chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, and cultural commentator. He's written a number of books, the most recent, of course, The Bulldozer and The Big Tent, Blind Republicans, Lame Democrats, and the Recovery of American Ideals. We could cover that one as well. And Media Unlimited. We'll also talk with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning journalist whose works appeared in The Nation, Salon, American Prospect, Washington Monthly. He essentially gate-crashed a right-wing political meeting recently in Washington, D.C., where he confronted the Reverend John Hagee, who is a prominent evangelical, considered the leading light in a group known as Christian Zionists. Interchange or exchange, if you will, was captured. It's on YouTube. It's available. Rapture Ready is the way to get to it on YouTube. We'll be talking to Max Blumenthal about his exploration and confrontation with the evangelicals, many of whom, of course, are supporting John McCain, in spite of the fact that one of their own, Huckabee, is running in the campaign. And of course, just this week, Senator McCain had to defend the endorsement from the Reverend John Hagee, who has been attacked by the head of the Catholic League, because Mr. Hagee's referred to the Catholic Church as being the Antichrist and a false cult. So I'll be talking to Max Blumenthal about the relationship that John McCain has with the evangelicals. And then we'll get a contrarian point of view on energy. Much of what is being discussed now in terms of energy independence is a fairly widespread belief that we have to stop spending our money on Saudi oil. Of course, we're borrowing Chinese money to buy Saudi oil, but many people feel that we're digging our own grave in that regard. And a contrarian book called Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence, we'll be discussing that. I'm now speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's professor of journalism and sociology and the chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. And he's also an American sociologist, political writer, novelist. His most recent book, The Bulldozer and The Big Tent, Blind Republicans, Lame Democrats, and the Recovery of American Ideals, and also Media Unlimited. And Todd Gitlin, it seems to me that the story that recently broke in the New York Times had caused a great deal of anguish and amongst the journalistic community, and a lot of editorials were written condemning the New York Times. Of course, the conservatives jumped on the bandwagon, and it turned out to be a welcome change from their attitude towards John McCain. They suddenly endorsed him because the gray lady was beating up on him. But to my mind, it looked to me like that whole exercise was an inoculation job, that where John McCain is essentially off the hook now in terms of anybody looking further into the real substance, assuming that there is some in that story, because the story itself was leaked by his own people. They provided an on-the-record guy. It was an incident that took place 8 years ago. And it feels like it's going to go away. Do you share my skepticism?
Not altogether. I think this story has a centipede, more legs that haven't yet materialized. When I say this story, I mean that the story of John McCain living a perfectly ordinary inside the Beltway life. John McCain, who grew up in Washington, John McCain, son of a lobbyist, military lobbyist, John McCain, a cozy player, John McCain, the instrument of the Charles Keating scandal before that proved to be imprudent, John McCain, the part-time maverick. I think the story of McCain's embeddedness with lobbyists is a story that will continue to unfold. And I say that not because I think the press has it in for them. We very much appreciate how seducible they were and how glamorously successful he's been up to this point in winning their hearts, but because there are 6 months before the primary, before the convention, and 6 months is a long time to go without journalism if you're a journalist, and you can't just keep writing love letters the whole time. So I think the fact that the Washington Post simultaneously ran an actually far better sourced and consistent article, and that other things are beginning to drip on the head of John McCain, I think suggests that there'll be more to come, but call me a cockeyed optimist.
Well, how do you explain, Todd Gitlin, the disparity where they had the story in the works for some time, and albeit largely sourced by people from the McCain campaign itself, previous and current, yet at the same time, the New York Times itself endorsed him.
Well, the story that's bruited about is that it was the publisher Arthur Sulzberger himself who rammed that endorsement, both actually endorsements, down the throats of the editorial board when they were not exactly enthusiastic. And
you're talking about Hillary Clinton, yes, and John McCain.
Yes, and so I do think it's true. I mean, at least I have no evidence that it's false, that the editorial board and the journalism side are incommunicado. I've never heard anything to the contrary. It is. I think it says something about the callowness and arbitrariness of Mr. Sulzberger, that knowing that this McCain piece was in the works, that he insisted on that endorsement anyway. I think it says something about his, imperfect grasp of the role of the publisher and his recklessness that he's willing to bite that bullet.
So I guess what you're saying here, Todd Gitlin, is that we know that Senator McCain is being lambasted by the conservatives, led by Rush Limbaugh, for being apparently, they think he's a stealth liberal because of McCain-Feingold, the campaign finance reform, and his other the stands that he's taken. They're beating him up over that. But you're suggesting, in fact, that the moderates and the liberals who see him as a reasonable Republican, you're not entirely convinced that his record bears out that.
Well, his record is long and checkered. He's going to be lambasted by libertarians like Matt Welch, the author of a campaign biography, quite unflattering, called, which came out in the fall to not much attention, but I expect may get a second life now, but called McCain, The Myth of a Moderate. He's going to be lambasted by all those who are holding fire because they see him as the man on the horse in the line of of Goldwater, Reagan, Bush. But I think especially as he becomes more vociferously and indefensively belligerent about Iraq, he is some of the scales will fall from the eyes. I could be wrong, but I do think, you know, 9 months now before the election, 8 months is a long time to hold your tongue. And I think there's still some, even though he's McCain's gotten a pass as a war hero, and that bought him a good deal of insulation. I still think 8 months is a long time for everyone to hush up. And we may not even have heard the last of the Vicky Eisman story. Who knows?
Well, everybody sort of beats up on the press for various reasons, but it seems to me that it's pretty clear that the idea is how you use the press. And I would make the observation that perhaps the Republicans are better at using the press than the Democrats are, in the sense that you essentially get them to write what you want as opposed to write what the other side wants. That's a fairly standard game.
I agree
game.
With that generalization.
Yeah, that's how the game is played, right?
Yeah.
And so in terms of my thesis about inoculation, in the sense that once you deliberately let a story out so that it'll get the headlines and then it'll disappear, there'll be no there, even though ostensibly the charges have been aired, and it sort of then inoculates the person from further investigation. That's the argument essentially that Dan Rather has in his $70 million suit against CBS, that they actually had that story right about George W. Bush's National Guard record. Do you think that if Rather's right, that they got set up by the White House, and the story actually is true, it certainly had the effect of inoculating George W. Bush against any further investigations.
Well, it certainly did have that effect. I'm kind of old-fashioned as a stickler for evidence in such cases, and while it certainly did benefit the Republicans greatly, it actually doubly benefited them. I'll come back to that in a minute. When the trail went stale on Bush's National Guard story because 60 Minutes had botched that particular story. The fact that it happened so close to the election meant there was no recovery time. The second disaster for CBS was that the story they shelved in order to run that story about Bush and the National Guard was the story about the infamous Nigerian uranium deal,
right? Exactly,
and which 60 Minutes had a real coup. They had an interview with the Italian Secret Service intermediary, and that piece, once shelved, was supposed to air. I believe the date was September 8th, 2004. Never ran. Still never been seen.
And it's an extremely important story in the context that all of this Plamegate stuff that went on with Scooter Libby, Valerie Plame, Ambassador Joe Wilson. The very heart of that was that the reason that Wilson was sent to Niger was to investigate the claims that turned out to be forged,
That's
based
right.
upon forged documents.
That's right.
And the story was basically who forged these documents. And
right.
and there are, you know, when I first revealed some time back that those forgeries were done over here, based upon an interview I did with a senior CIA guy, and he refused to say who it was or where he got his evidence from, and so I said, well, if it was done over here, if I mentioned the name Michael Ledeen, what would you say? And he sort of laughed and said, you'd be very close. And immediately Ledeen threatened to sue me and all this stuff. So I'm very familiar with this story. And to my mind, the fact that I was alone out there and 60 Minutes have been still sitting on this story to this day is just infuriating.
Yeah. The fact, though, that the Republicans were beneficiaries of the 60 Minutes collapse,
and they got rid of Rather, who they hated.
Yes, the fact that they were the beneficiaries, however, doesn't prove that they were the leakers. And you know, they may have been, but they may not have been. And you know, I haven't heard a convincing case that they were the leakers. So you know,
well,
qui bono is a good question to ask about the consequences of a piece of journalism, but it's not a question that answers itself.
Right. The evidence, though, that it looked like a setup was that John Roberts, now with CNN, was then the White House correspondent for CBS, and he went over there because the White House said, we hear you've got this story in the works and we want to rebut it. And the head of communications, Bartlett, he met with him. He brought all the documentation because he wanted them to see what they had. And they came back to him and said, we don't have a problem with this documentation. And then he immediately called Rather and said, the White House doesn't have any problem with this. And, of course, that ended up to be where the real problem was. So maybe I'm...
That might be accessory after the fact, but
right.
That still doesn't explain how these bad documents ended up in Dan Rather's hands.
And well, maybe...
In my view, it doesn't exculpate me.
Right.
Him from a piece of very bad journalism.
Well, if he thinks he's going to collect $70 million, I guess he's going to have to come up with that evidence, right?
Well, I don't think he's going to collect it. But
do you think he'll have the evidence to make his case?
I don't know what he has.
So what, in terms of, back to that, the notion that the press is there to be used and the race goes to the swiftest, is ever the best, better at using it, that seems to have become a part of our kind of political reality here. The Democrats for the longest time were feeling injured by Karl Rove, and you got the impression that they were wistfully hoping that there was a Democratic Karl Rove out there somewhere that they could employ. I mean, does this exemplify the state of our politics? Is this the way it is and will be?
Well, there are dirty players on both teams. Rove found his moment, found his candidate, was not foolproof, made mistakes, but was diabolical and effective. And of course, effectiveness is the name of the game. So everybody thinks that he walks on water after the fact. If Ralph Nader had stayed in bed in 2000, Karl Rove wouldn't have been the great political genius of our time. And not only would Gore have won Florida, but he would have won New Hampshire, where Bush won by 4,000 votes, while Nader got something like 22,000. So, much credit to Karl Rove for his iniquity, but I don't think he's foolproof.
Well, just in closing, Todd Gitlin, do you expect, in the absence of Rove, nevertheless, I'm sure the Republican Party have others that can work, and in fact, Rove is I think, could be hired. Do you expect, as many do, that Senator Obama, if he's the nominee, will be, it seems to me what the Republicans are doing now is they're killing him with kindness. All of the big Republican op-ed writers like Brooks and Crystal and others are just ladling and lavishing praise on Obama. And so is while they're taking the high road, do you think others will take the low road?
Oh, others have already started taking the low road. I mean, the low road will tunnel under and will make frequent stops. Jonah Goldberg, the author of a ridiculous book called Liberal Fascism, has come forward in the Los Angeles Times with an op-ed piece about how Obama is a creature of bygone American terrorists. We'll hear this whole over and over again. The saga of Barack Hussein Obama, Farrakhan, Muslim, Weatherman, Resco,
already
Palestinian
there's a,
terrorist. Well, that refrain will be swift boating around the corner any minute now.
Already there's an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times suggesting that Obama's repudiation of Farrakhan in his debate with Hillary Clinton was not sufficient. I mean, what do you have to do?
The right-wing AIPAC sort of people will carry this water. The attempt will be to define him in the coming months as the Manchurian candidate,
who's a stealth Muslim out to get Israel.
Yeah.
Well, on that note...
Stay tuned.
Thank you so much for joining us,
Todd. Okay,
Todd,
sure. Bye-bye. Okay, take care.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. I was just speaking then with Todd Gitlin, who's professor of journalism and sociology and the chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He's also the author of a number of books on the media, The Bulldozer and the Big Tent, Blind Republicans, Lame Democrats, and the Recovery of American Ideals, and Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. And I'm now speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning journalist. His work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, The American Prospect, and The Washington Monthly, and other publications. He is a fellow at The Nation Institute and a research fellow at Media Matters for America. His blog is maxblumenthal.com. And for the last 4 years, he's covered right-wing political movements in the United States. Last July, he covered a rally held by Christian Zionist evangelical, including the Reverend John Hagee in Washington, D.C., and this highly praised video report on that event entitled Rapture Ready has been viewed by hundreds of thousands on YouTube. Max, how do you get this on YouTube? You go to YouTube and then type in...
Type in Rapture Ready on the search mechanism. You can also go to Google and type in my name and... You can write Rapture Ready or Pastor John Hagee and it'll come up.
Well, this week, the Republican... nominee, for all intents and purposes, John McCain, defended his endorsement of the Reverend John Hagee. This is in the face of criticism from the president of the Catholic League, Bill Donahue, who released a statement calling on Senator McCain to repudiate the endorsement because Donahue feels that Mr. Hagee's war on the Catholic Church is evident, and he's called the Catholic Church the Antichrist and a false cult. Do you think that the fact that the evangelicals are coming to McCain in spite of the fact that they have one of their own there to vote for, Huckabee, who's still in the race, does this indicate that these guys are interested in political power, not in the purity of their ideals?
Well, Pastor John Hagee's a huckster, and in his first and foremost, his goal is to court power, make lots of money, and he had inroads with John McCain. He also was really close to Mike Huckabee, too, and paid Mike Huckabee recently $2,000 in speaker fees, which is actually, a concealed campaign donation for Mike Huckabee to give two sermons at his church, Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, which has 18,000 members. Pastor John Hagee is one of the most powerful, not only as a televangelist, but as a political figure in Texas. He's really close to the Republican political establishment there. And John McCain has been courting Hagee's endorsement since May 2007, which was before Mike Huckabee ever started courting Hagee's endorsement. So I think the evangelical leadership, especially the Pentecostal hucksters like Hagee, who are in it for the money and the power, are going to come to McCain because they have an agenda. Another thing worth pointing out is that the Catholic bigotry on the part of Pastor Hagee, the anti-Catholic bigotry, is only the tip of the iceberg. Pastor Hagee is one of the most fanatical anti-Muslim, anti-Arab figures in American life. He is so extreme, so conspiratorial, and so dead set on pushing and lobbying for violent incursions in the Middle East, for the bombing of Iran. You know, he makes Louis Farrakhan look like Todd Gitlin. He's one of the most extreme figures in American life, and you know, Louis Farrakhan endorsed Barack Obama. I didn't see Barack Obama courting the endorsement. John McCain has actively courted Pastor Hagee's endorsement. So I went to Pastor Hagee's conference last year. It's called the Washington Israel Summit because he runs a massive lobbying group that rivals the power of AIPAC, and what they lobby for is for the U.S. to endorse Israel's attacks on Gaza, to endorse more settlement activity in the West Bank, because they believe that John Hagee and his organization, Christians United for Israel, believe that greater Israel, that means Israel and all of Palestine, is going to be the landing pad for the Messiah. That's why he's called a Christian Zionist. And he's made this sort of alliance with groups like AIPAC, with the ADL, with the Israel lobby, and with a lot of synagogues that I consider naive. And you know, he's done this on the basis of his support for Israel and shepherding evangelicals into a supposedly pro-Israel position. He's also close to figures like Benjamin Netanyahu, the Likudnik former prime minister of Israel. And beneath the surface, though, below the radar, me and several researchers, you know, started pouring through Hagee's writings to discover that he is also one of the most anti-Semitic figures in American life. If you look at his book, Jerusalem Countdown, which is a New York Times bestseller because his, you know, evangelical flock, you know, they buy up tens of thousands of his books, he blames the Jews for their own persecution. He says on page 92 of his book, it was the disobedience and rebellion of the Jews, God's chosen people, to their covenantal responsibility to serve the one true God, Jehovah, that gave rise to the opposition and persecution that they experienced beginning in Canaan and continuing to this very day. I don't think you could have a more clearly anti-Semitic statement than that by someone who claims to be a friend of the Jews, a friend of Israel, and who's courted by the Israel lobby, and who's courted by major presidential candidates, and stood on stage with John McCain and in a major press conference for McCain to court the evangelical base. He needs to be held account for this. And so at a press conference at the Christians United for Israel conference last July, I quoted this back to Pastor Hagee.
And you got tossed out.
And, you know, within 5 minutes, a team of off-duty D.C. police officers ushered me out of the place. So it's time for the press to start asking McCain about these statements that Hagee's made and to ask Hagee about these. But instead, you know, because Pastor Hagee's just considered a leader of so-called value voters, no one asked these questions. We're too busy focusing on statements Louis Farrakhan made 20 years ago, which I think, you know, they deserve to be focused on, and Barack Obama should reject them, but, you know, why?
He rejected them, and it became so semantical in the arguments with Hillary Clinton.
Well, he at first refused to reject it, and no one wants to acknowledge the fact that he at first refused to reject it until Hillary pushed him to do so, and that's just a fact that, you know, can't be denied, and McCain should be pushed to do the same thing.
Well, what's happening with this investigation into these evangelicals by Senator Grassley? He's targeted a few of them. Copeland, I believe, is one of them that he's targeted over their IRS tax exemption,
right,
where they are restricted in the sense that they can educate, in quotes, as opposed to advocate. The fact that Hagee gave a presidential candidate $2,000 should disqualify him. Is Hagee on Grassley's list?
Hagee's not on Grassley's list, but he's sort of in the constellation of Pentecostal hucksters who are on Grassley's list. You know, people on that list are like Joyce Meyer, who flies around in her own private $7 million jet. She's actually accused by Grassley of using her donations to buy, I'm not making this up, golden toilet seats, which is just like what the Pentagon did in the Reagan years, if anyone remembers that. Copeland is on the list, Kenneth Copeland. He was a big supporter of Mike Huckabee, and there was a little bit of a controversy around Huckabee for cozying up to Copeland. But Pastor Hagee's no different from any of these people. What I found at his conference, besides the extremism, besides the Islamophobia, and besides the covert conspiratorial anti-Semitism, was a hucksterism. He's exploiting well-meaning, uneducated people who are having a hard time in life, and he's promised them some sort of great beyond, that they're going to go to heaven, and all they have to do is give him lots of money, and the money's all going to go to create a safe place for the Messiah to come back in the promised land, and everyone's going to be raptured up to heaven in the end. So I watched these people just open their purses and open their wallets for Hagee right in front of me, and he makes more than Kenneth Copeland or any other televangelist in America. His salary has been approved by himself and his board of directors, which consists entirely of his own family members. So, you know, he lives in a 5,000-square-foot Greek Revival mansion outside of Dallas, and then he has something like a 20,000-acre ranch. Outside of San Antonio, he has a 20,000-acre ranch in Texas. And when the state discovered that he was using too much water, he was basically violating Texas's water laws, you know, because they don't get a lot of rainfall down there. He paid the biggest Republican lobbyist in the state to change the water laws.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what he's doing, you know, with the collection plate. Besides being an extremist, he's an exploiter and a sociopath.
And what about this guy, Crouch, out here, Trinity?
Oh, Paul Crouch.
He's got some problems with
young... he's a homosexual. That's a problem that he has, considering that he's operating an officially anti-gay television network, Trinity Broadcasting Network.
So that woman with the extraordinary hair and makeup, wife...
He inspired Amy Winehouse's hair.
so they're not, they have separate beds. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know where she sleeps, but he has tried to sleep with his male driver and was accused of sexual harassment. So that was a big problem for them, and he went off the air for some time. And now he's back on the air as if nothing happened. And I don't know if he went into ex-gay therapy with Ted Haggard, but, you know... I don't think Pastor Hagee is on his network, but they're all in the same constellation of people who are, you know, exploiting naive, well-meaning evangelicals for their money and using the money for sinister means, and they're courting power
to protect that money. Because I mean, you've got to admire a Republican senator like Grassley for taking on this issue.
But the Hagee endorsement has foreign policy implications too. I mean, you just can't forget. That he isn't a guy who just runs around saying crazy things. He's a guy who has, you know, Arlen Specter's former chief of staff on his payroll, lobbying for him, lobbying against a two-state solution in Israel, lobbying for more settlement activity, lobbying to bomb Iran. I watched Joseph Lieberman at Pastor Hagee's conference last year call him a man greater than who commands a flock greater than the flock that Moses commanded. I mean, this is. You know, Joseph Lieberman's comparing Pastor Hagee to Moses. Roy Blunt, the former minority leader in the House, was there. John McCain showed up for a quick speech that the press was not allowed to attend. So, you know, this is a guy with, you know, deep pockets, deep connections, and he has a major interest in seeing more violence and bloodshed in the Middle East. I just can't overstate enough the peril of you know, Pastor Hagee having a voice in the White House.
Well, in that video that's on YouTube, Rapture Ready, I noticed that you talked with Tom DeLay, who said he was ready to be raptured. I mean, he was really rapture ready. Any minute he wanted to go. And then a couple of other people who were there, you asked them for the keys to their Cadillacs if they're about to go.
Right.
Do you think that one could start a counter movement in this country for people to start, you know, promising their Cadillacs and the titles to their houses, all of which, of course, will be worthless if you and me and the rest of humanity is stuck in the lake of fire?
Well, yeah, I mean, every cloud has a silver lining, and I think if there is the rapture, I think it'll be great because all these people will finally leave and we'll get rid of them, and then we can have, have our own socialist democracy or whatever we want.
Just in closing, Max Blumenthal, I want to go back to the thesis that I ran by Todd Gitlin, who, you know, teaches journalism at Columbia, and of course the New York Times being the local paper. They came out recently with a story about McCain they didn't say it, but they implied that he'd had an affair with a female lobbyist who was actually had business before his committee. And this story was leaked to the Times by people that are on McCain's staff. They then provided the on-the-record guy who was worked on the 2000 campaign, McCain's 2000 campaign. He was able to verify that he indeed did meet with this woman and urged her not to hang out with McCain because they were getting worried that he was spending a lot of time with her and traveling around on jets with her, etc., on private jets. So the interesting thing to my mind is that for all the huffing and puffing that went on in the press about how dare they do this, and the LA Times had op-ed pieces decrying this gutter journalism, the long and the short of it is it looks like this was a piece where the New York Times obligingly inoculated John McCain against further investigations in this regard. And it's a tactic that is often used where you float a story, put it out there, you know, without all of the real information. And even, you know, to some extent, Obama inoculated himself against discussions like Clinton's I Didn't Inhale in his own biography
right.
by talking
right.
about his cocaine and use, et cetera. So I just wondered, just in closing, whether you're of a like mind to me that
right. Well, I wondered where the story came from. A lot of times, these stories are floated by other campaigns.
Right. Well, this one came from the McCain campaign, which is why I think we've all been had. Plus, there's I know personally of people
Weaver.
That he's sexually harassed. You know.
Sorry, it came partly from John Weaver, if I'm not...
Yeah, it did. He
right.
was the guy that went on the record, yeah.
Yeah, and we're supposed to believe that John Weaver has this acrimonious relationship with McCain because he was fired. But, you know, this is the guy that would comb John McCain's hair every day on the campaign trail.
Right.
He was so loyal to him because McCain can't lift his arms
right.
that high from being tortured. So
right.
I agree with you, and I think it's curious that the New York Times held it until Mitt Romney was finished.
Hmm. And then now he's talked about getting back in the race. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Max Blumenthal, award-winning journalist. His confrontation with the Christian Zionists at their big rally with John Hagee is available at YouTube. Just go to Rapture Ready. Let's now go to the contrarian view of our energy independence and the alternatives that have been proffered thus far. I'm speaking with Robert Bryce, who's one of America's foremost energy journalists. He's currently the managing editor of Energy Tribune and a contributing writer for the Texas Observer. The author of Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron, and Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. His new book we're discussing now, Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. And I guess you're raining on a lot of people's parade here. I mean, you're more or less saying that energy independence is a chimera.
Well, absolutely. And you know, that's been one of the most interesting things about this presidential campaign is that you have all of the candidates essentially saying they favor energy independence. And the fact is that, you know, and that was really one of the motivating reasons for writing this book was that when you look at it, when you look at the numbers and no matter how you look at them and you look at the facts, this idea of energy independence is hogwash. The U.S., along with nearly every other country on the planet, is energy interdependent. And the idea that the U.S., as the world's single biggest energy consumer, can divorce itself from the world's single biggest business, which is the $5 trillion a year energy business, is ludicrous on its face.
Well, as you probably know, Robert, we had an interesting... The president had an interesting press conference this week. It was pointed out to him that gasoline costs will probably rise past $4 in the summer, and he acted like he'd never heard of such a thing.
Sure.
We do have a clear run-up in oil. We've had, in effect, this country, you know, has a... It doesn't have the social safety nets that the rest of the democracies have in terms of health care and other social services, but it's always had cheap food and cheap energy.
Sure.
So are those days gone?
Well, let me address the issue of cheap food first. I think one of the reasons that we're clearly seeing this huge surge in the cost of food is because of our misbegotten energy policy with regard to the ethanol scam. You know, Congress has tried to intervene in the energy market and has mandated the use of corn ethanol. And by instituting this kind of mandate, they have entirely queered the global commodities market because the U.S. Distilleries are using so much corn to produce motor fuel in an effort to meet the mandates. So yes, I mean this era of cheap food, relatively cheap food, has ended at least for the time being, in part because Congress has mandated such a crazy idea in terms of energy policy. Now, energy prices, yes, we're seeing huge run-ups in energy prices over the past few years. And why is that? Well, partly is, again, it is the global market, you know, the rise of China and India in particular, Pakistan, all the countries of the world as they develop are using more energy, and we haven't had a corresponding increase in overall production in terms of oil. Prices of natural gas haven't risen quite as much as oil, but nevertheless, yeah, I mean, we're seeing, you know, huge price increases, and there are a lot of factors for it.
Well, I think it's pretty established that ethanol is a boondoggle. It costs more to produce ethanol than it yields. It also the cellulose ethanol hasn't yet materialized, although people act as though
sure.
It's a reality. But the real what's being emerged from this post 9/11 Middle East crisis, obviously exacerbated by the Iraq War, it's been a boon for the energy companies to go back to their atavistic products and say, we have to become energy self-sufficient. The coal companies are all running and beating that drum on and jumping on that bandwagon. So are the nuclear companies. So are our only alternatives to go back to these extremely detrimental forms of energy vis-a-vis global warming, particularly coal. And by the way, the coal companies are buying media time on all of the news programs. They're sponsoring presidential debates, PBS programs, etc. So they seem to be quite aggressive.
Well, I think I may have to disagree with you on one part of this, and that is, you know, I don't hear this drumbeat for energy independence coming from the energy companies. The drumbeat for energy independence has come from the politicos, from the politicians, and from the from the neoconservatives. I mean, one of the main points that I make in Gusher of Lies is that when you look at the history of this modern push for energy independence in America, it is largely coming from the same people who were the some of the main promoters of the second Iraq War. So now think about that for a minute. So you know, you look at this, you know, this push for the second Iraq War, which, as we know, hasn't gone very well, and now we're going to trust these same people who want energy independence to formulate America's energy policy. Isn't that kind of like asking Britney Spears to babysit your kids? Or asking, you know, Dick Cheney to take you hunting? I mean, this is fundamentally a bad idea. So, you know, what we have to do when we look forward at energy policy in America is accept this idea of energy interdependence. And we can badmouth the oil companies and the coal companies if it makes you feel good, but the fact is we've got to accept the reality of the global market.
Well, but we've also got to accept the reality of the consequences of going back to coal. And nuclear there's no question that nuclear is being revisited as the answer to global warming.
I
mean,
sure.
And there's no question that the coal companies are in their advertising are using the specter of us paying the jihadis to kill us every time we fill up our car. So there's no question that they're jumping on the bandwagon, but. What are the choices then? If you're suggesting that there's really there's no way that the alternatives that are being pushed now are going to work,
right?
What's going to fill the breach here? If
sure, well, I mean, just one, you know, just to, you know, I understand where you're going with your arguments, but just a couple of points that I make in Gusher of Lies in terms of the realities of the global market. In 2005, the U.S. bought crude oil from 41 countries. We bought gasoline from 46 and jet fuel from 26. So this, you know, first, this idea that somehow we're funding the jihadis by buying oil, it's just patently false. This idea that of conflating oil and terrorism has been used effectively by the neoconservatives and by politicians to say, you know, oil is bad and therefore, you know, if we quit using oil, terrorism will go away. Well, fundamentally, that's just not true. Okay, so, you know, if you oppose coal, that's fine. You know, coal provides 52% of the electricity, you know, now produced in America. You know, my point is, okay, you can dislike it, but the fact is for the near term, and I think the near term is the next 10 to 20 years, we're not going to be able to change fundamentally that number to any great extent. nuclear, again, you know, if you don't like it, that's fine. My point is you have to pick your poison. You know, if you don't like CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, are we going to have uranium, you know, radioactive waste, you know, and deal with that? Well, maybe that's going to have to be the choice. One of the things that I think, you know, looking forward, you know, if you don't like those options, is the use of increasing use of natural gas. And this, it's surprising to me that this aspect is not getting the kind of attention that I think it deserves. And here are the numbers. We import just about 20% of our natural gas. We import 60% of our oil. Natural gas is the cleanest of the fossil fuels, emits virtually no pollution when it's burned on the ground. Yes, it emits CO2, but it emits only half as much CO2 as coal. We're finding more natural gas reserves than we are oil reserves. Natural gas is more dispersed. It is available in more countries. So, you know, if we want a cleaner fuel, I think that there should be a more promotion of natural gas, particularly for the terrestrial transportation market. It's a very good transportation fuel. So, you know, that's one option I can offer right off the bat, and yet is largely being ignored.
And what about conservation?
Well, I'm all for efficiency, and, you know, but I just published a piece, in fact, on Friday at Counterpunch, on counterpunch.com, talking about the issue of efficiency. And, you know, I think there's no question that efficiency is a good idea, and efficiency can decrease the rate of growth of demand for new energy. But at the same time, we have to understand something that is axiomatic. Energy is like sex, horsepower, and bandwidth, and that is the more we get, the more we want. And so efficiency, while being a good thing, won't necessarily, and this is counterintuitive, it won't necessarily reduce overall energy consumption. And that has been proven over and over. And that's one of the points that I make in my Counterpunch piece. It's called the Jevons Paradox. Energy efficiency doesn't decrease energy consumption. In fact, it often leads, and usually does, to increased energy consumption.
But if all the cars, I mean, you know, the head of GM apparently thinks that global warming is a hoax, and you know that how intransigent Detroit has been in adapting to everything, going back to seat belts, catalytic converters, and they're very slow on the hybrids. If all the cars on the road were hybrids and all the diesel trains and diesel buses, et cetera, were hybrids, what difference would that make?
Well, you know, it could make a big difference in terms of oil demand. But again, you know, is that going to be just oil demand in the U.S., or is it ultimately going to make a great deal of difference in overall global demand? I can't necessarily answer that question. I do have a graphic in Gusher of Lies that I think is one of perhaps the most interesting of the graphics in the whole book, and it's one that I took from the National Commission on Energy Policy in 2004. And they looked at efficiency standards for domestic automobiles, and they estimated that even if the U.S. doubled CAFE standards, the Corporate Average Fuel Economy standards, that by 2025, I believe if memory serves, that U.S. oil demand would still increase by 3.3 million barrels a day. Now, that's not to say that, you know, increasing efficiency in the auto fleet isn't a good idea, but we have to be realistic about what the overall increase is going to do over the long term. People are driving more. We have, you know, the population is growing, you know, and the economy is growing. As it does, people are driving more. And so, you know, the efficiency gains that we might get from CAFE standards may well be swallowed by, you know, that increased consumption overall. So, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I'm no Dr. Pangloss here and saying everything's going to work out, but, you know, as prices rise, demand is going to be destroyed. And so ultimately, the market is going to stay in balance. How high will prices go? I don't know.
Well, if peak oil is as advertised, then the prices will rise. As demand increases, supply will decrease, prices will rise.
Sure. Well, and I think that that's the one, you know, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, one of the points that I make in my book, and it's not necessarily the, you know, the end result that I went looking for when I began writing the book, is that, you know, that ultimately has to be the case. We have to understand that price is really the only thing that ultimately will make the difference and drive the market and consumers toward alternative sources of energy. And when you look back at energy demand, overall energy demand in the U.S., the only time that we've seen a significant decrease is after there has been a really rapid increase in price. And so while it is painful, I fully realize it, I see it every time I fill up, while it is painful to see these big increases in price, they are the things that are actually going to drive the market toward more solar, toward more wind, toward more whatever whatever might be the next great technology. And I think that clearly one of the keys – you know, if I were king, what would be the things I would promote? Well, natural gas would be one. The other is promoting an efficient storage technology. You know, our battery technology still is lagging way behind the market, and, you know, it's been problematic since Thomas Edison's day.
Well, that would solve most of the transportation, at least in terms of personal use. If you had a 200, 300-mile range battery,
it would be huge.
We wouldn't be having this conversation.
It could be enormous. But now, remember, you still have to get the electricity from somewhere. And so what's your choice? Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, there's the overnight grid, which a lot of people point out is not being used. So.
Well, of course. But see, you know, there's the other part of this, and I have a part in Gusher of Lies where I talk about, you know, this is the game changer really is a super battery. And I, you know, I promote an idea that, you know, it's mine. I actually borrowed it from Václav Smil, who's a distinguished professor of geography at the University of Manitoba, who I have a great deal of respect for, really a fantastic energy writer. And he said, you know, everyone's talking about reducing CO2. Well, that's fine, or trying to sequester CO2. He said the best idea is not to produce it in the first place. And what's the way to do that? It would be to have a super high-capacity battery. And so that if you had, you know, electric utilities that could then store, you know, run their generators at night and create, you know, pump juice into these, you know, huge batteries and then feed that out onto the system during the day, you would be able to smooth out that sine wave of demand that occurs over the 24-hour period. And that would be enormous.
But clearly, Robert Bryce, that the consumer and the public, if they had clean, if you, for example, had a hydrogen car that emitted water mist instead of noxious fuels that are causing CO2 and leading to global warming, we'd all be happy. So we have to be clear about whether or not any of this stuff is really possible. The president himself said that kids born today, their first car will be a hydrogen car. I mean, he made a lot of promises, but put no money behind it. So,
right. I don't think that that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, his idea about, you know, first kids driving a hydrogen car, you know, look, people have been talking about hydrogen for decades. And, you know, I fully understand that, you know, the goal. The problem is hydrogen is just it's an energy carrier. It's not a source.
Mm-hmm. I understand that, but are you writing it off altogether?
No, I'm not writing it off altogether. One of the other points that I make in Gusher of Lies that I think is a positive trend that isn't discussed much is the trend of decarbonization. You know, what's happened over the last, this isn't my theory, it really was pushed by Jesse Ossebel, who's the director of the Project for the Human Program for the Human Environment at Rockefeller University in New York. You know, he looked at, since about 1800, and looked at the carbon intensity of the global economy, how much carbon is being expended for each unit of economic output. And he has clearly charted that the amount of carbon intensity in the global economy is declining. And that's because consumers are naturally seeking ever denser, ever cleaner forms of fuel. And that's why, again, I think this trend toward natural gas is a positive one. Instead of coal, which has, we started with wood, we went to coal, we're now really in the midst of the oil age. Natural gas has 1/40th as much carbon as wood. It is about 4 times cleaner than coal in terms of carbon intensity. So this decarbonization is actually, you get to the methane molecule, which is CH4, you get 4 hydrogen atoms for every carbon atom. You know, that is taking us on the road toward the hydrogen economy, and the hydrogen economy is largely going to be fueled by natural gas that's been split, that's, you know, where hydrogen atoms are being peeled off of the carbon atoms.
And you don't see solar farms then as a way to produce hydrogen through electrolysis?
Well, I think that's absolutely could be a very, you know, that could be a very useful way to, you know, produce hydrogen. The question, of course, then is economics. I'm fully in favor of solar. I live in Austin. I have 3,200 watts of photovoltaic panels on my roof here in my house. So, you know, I think that solar definitely has a lot of potential. The question is, you know, at what cost? And I think that, you know, until we get the kind of economies of scale in the solar business that allows it to get to that point where you're discussing of, you know, cracking water to produce hydrogen. You know, we have to see how fast it can scale up and where it can go.
And biodiesel for the rural sector, which is often discussed as a
sure.
as an alternative. Where do you place that in terms of practicality?
Sure. Well, I'm skeptical on biofuels in general, just because, you know, of my, you know, the things that I've seen in the ethanol scam. There's clearly a role, though, for biodiesel that's produced by, you know, from, you know, waste oil from vegetable oil and so on. And it clearly makes sense in a lot of areas where there is a surfeit of soybeans or a surfeit of other materials that can be turned into to either diesel or ethanol. But the problem rises when, you know, government is mandating, oh, we have to make it from this source or that source, where you create an artificial effort to force something into the market.
And right. So, well, that's the Archer Daniel Midland's lobbying effort.
Absolutely.
And I mean, we know that we're subject to all kinds of hoaxes, and as I was saying earlier, all kinds of people are jumping on the bandwagon vis-a-vis, and their solutions are not necessarily the right ones. But they're the ones that are getting funded.
Sure.
That's why, you know, your book is a helpful piece of clarity here, Gusher of Lies. But just in closing, you don't want to reinforce despair here because...
No, absolutely not.
We are, I think, at a crisis mode. So just give us your final sense of where we should go with a sensible energy policy.
Well, I think, you know, the sensible energy policy, I think, begins, you know, with this kind of understanding that, you know, the American government cannot force, you know, new technologies to mature. We have to accept this idea that we are going to be part of the global economy in everything from iPods and fresh flowers to gasoline and jet fuel for decades to come. So, one, it's accepting this idea of energy interdependence. Second, it's getting over this idea that we have to militarize the Persian Gulf to have energy security. I think if there's one thing that has been more costly than perhaps any other, it's this militarization equals energy security equation, and it has been fundamentally wrong for 30 years, and it's being proven wrong even as we speak with our misadventure with the second Iraq war. So I think those are the first two. And then I think, you know, third, looking forward, you know, promote more use of natural gas. This is a clean fuel. It's one that you know, should be embraced by the environmental groups as one that is a viable alternative in the near term and over the long term. And then, you know, once we move past that, let's have the argument over, you know, should it be nuclear? Should it be solar? Should it be wind? Fine. You know, let the economics fight it out.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Robert Bryce.
Thanks a million, Ian.
Thank you. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Robert Bryce, one of America's foremost energy journalists, a contrarian at that. I would like to thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, and Lictor Wan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.